This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, a college class examines the impact a large factory closure had on one Illinois town. The state is losing population, but some communities are making more of an effort to get people to stay. We'll meet a man who has spent years traveling the country, trying to help people after tragedies like mass shootings.
And immediately when I put crosses in a grouping, whether it's Nashville at the Waffle House, it changes everybody. First thing they do is quit talking about the gunman. That was a major goal. Talk about the victims here.
We'll hear from the creator of Crosses for Losses. And we'll learn about a service to help the blind enjoy live sporting events in real time. All that and more coming up on Statewide. Stay with us. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, population loss in Illinois is a cause for concern. We'll hear how one community is working to convince people to stay. The blind can attend live sporting events and follow the action on the radio, but the play-by-play is delayed a few seconds from what's taking place. We'll hear about a service that is specifically designed to solve that problem. And we meet a man who has made it his mission to provide comfort to those suffering from tragedies. Those stories and more ahead. About 1,600 people lost their jobs when a major Western Illinois employer closed and moved to Mexico in 2004. Years later, students in a class at Monmouth College set out to find out what happened to the former Maytag employees. Herb Trix reports.
The class last year was called Politics and Government in the Midwest, and it looked at the impact of globalization in the Midwest using Maytag as a case study. The teacher, Robin Johnson, says over two semesters his students talked with 65 former employees who used to make refrigerators in the plant. The project was called Voices of Maytag. Johnson says some workers found other jobs, such as with the railroad in Galesburg, while others retired, and some took classes to learn new skills.
For every person, I think, that came through it okay, I think there were others that struggled and made less money. So it was an interesting discussion the students had, and how do you define success? How do you define well-being? And sometimes some of the folks felt like it wasn't totally defined in money. They were making less money, but they achieved happiness from other things, being around their family, for example.
He says the person's eventual success or happiness partly depended on whether the former Maytag worker was a man or a woman.
Women were more likely to take training and reinvent themselves and move on to new careers, and men didn't. And the students came up with the idea that perhaps men in the traditional breadwinner role just had more difficulty transitioning. Not everybody could go into, say, healthcare careers, things like that.
One of the students in the class, Maggie Bruckner, interviewed a former employee who now works as a custodian at Monmouth College. The woman called Maytag a community where she knew everyone, loved her job, and felt secure.
She said if she could go back to Maytag, she would. At the time, like the pay would have been better if she was in that same position now. And then she would have retired last March, she said.
And Bruckner calls what the company did to these workers heartbreaking and sad.
From the human perspective and looking at all the lives that were affected by this one company closing their facility in Galesburg, it affected the entire town. It affected towns right next to it, because once that money stopped circulating from people working at Maytag, other businesses in the town ended up failing as well.
Will Stefanison says the worker he interviewed also missed the camaraderie of the Maytag plant and workers' sense of community, something she's not experienced at her subsequent jobs.
You know, I asked her, how did you have to cut back? And she, oh yeah, everything. Everyone had to cut back after Maytag because the jobs weren't paying as much. She said it's taken her 17 years to get the same pay at Blick that she was getting when she retired at Maytag.
He also points the difference between where he lives in the Chicago metro area and Galesburg, where the loss of hundreds of jobs really has an impact.
From that, I was able to get perspective and to see, kind of get a better understanding of what the loss of manufacturing jobs has meant to rural areas as a whole. Because that's just something you hear, for me in the suburbs, you hear about it on the news, but this was actually really learning about it and learning how it's affecting people.
Johnson says his students at Monmouth College love this project, interviewing the former workers at Maytag.
I just think it's a testament to the human spirit of people that got knocked down and the ability to get back up. And my students saw that, you know, in the old days, you could work someplace 30 years, like a lot of the former Maytag people did that retired, luckily, before the plant closed, and had a good retirement. That type of economy is no more now, and a lot of the students in the class, as I told them, unfortunately, will face situations where involuntarily they'll be out of a job. How are they going to face that? Perhaps they'll learn something from these Maytag folks and how they were able to persevere and get up off the mat.
The Voices of Maytag project is subtitled, A Look Back at a Factory Closure and Its Impact on People, Communities, and the American Dream. I'm Herb Trix.
2 years after closing the plant in Galesburg, Maytag also shuttered a plant in southern Illinois in the town of Herron. It employed more than 1,000 people at that time. Losing a child is every parent's worst nightmare, and for Justin Baker, helping families through grief is a full-time job. He's with St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. Tim Shelley with member station WCBU spoke with Baker about how he guides parents and siblings after a child dies at the hospital and how others can use those experiences to help someone who loses a loved one.
The word compassion actually means calm, which means together with, and pati means to suffer, and so it truly means to suffer with. So I try to be compassionate and suffer with those who are suffering. And I think the best way and the first step is just to hear a story about their child. You know, tell me about Nick. Tell me what he was like. Tell me more about some of those great memories that you have about him. And every parent whose children have died, they all want to tell their children's story. And they have no more memories to make. And so every memory they make with you, every memory they teach other people about their child is how their child lives on, and that's what they want.
Grieving can be different for everybody. What are some of the ways you see people grieve? If we talk about the classic five stages, I mean, is that something you see?
I think the five stages have been a little bit misunderstood across time. Those five stages were really never set up as sequential, although they've always been reported as sequential. What I see is that any one of those five, or two or three of those five at the same time, really can occur recurrently, or occur in bursts, or occur triggered at an unforeseen moment. And so your first question is, you know, what is typical grief? And there really is no such thing as typical grief, especially for parents who are grieving. What we've come to understand is that unless there are significant issues related to self-harm or issues related to truly not being able to get out of bed in the morning or not caring for activities of daily living or other children, we try to encourage families to walk through each day and do the very best that they can that day. And what we've seen is over and over again, people will have issues related to denial or issues related to yearning or issues related to any of the stages and all sorts of other things at the same time. And so it is best to be said that grief is an incredibly individual experience.
We've talked about the parents, but if child who passes away has a younger brother or sister, how do you talk to them about that? How is that different than how you're helping the parents through the grieving process?
Children are going through their own developmental milestones, and each kind of developmental aspect of every child happens in a different timeline. And it's the same with how they work through their grief and bereavement. And so just like parents, it has to be incredibly individualized. While children are treated with cancer, it's very common that their siblings feel left out, that their siblings feel like an other than. They feel like they're not the ones receiving all of the attention. So in a situation where a child who has cancer, it's clear that they're going to die, we pay tremendous attention to siblings because we recognize that you can't help but as a sibling feel different than the other child that has cancer. And so we want to walk with them and encourage them to express their own emotions and feelings. We do this in the midst of a very strong interdisciplinary team that has child life specialists who really are developmental specialists, social workers, child psychologists, chaplains, nurses, and physicians, a very multidisciplinary team. Something we're incredibly deliberate about, and we watch really closely, as well as providing anticipatory guidance to the parents as to what they should be looking for.
Is there anything else you would like people in general to know?
when you come in contact with somebody who has whatever aspect of suffering, if it's someone going through a divorce, if it's that their own parents died, even if they're elderly parents, or they're going through financial struggles or just really blue, our tendency as a society is just to pass right on by. Or in the midst of real suffering, these parents tell us all the time that they have such a strong relationship with their community, they'll come to St. Jude and get very close with the families at St. Jude. Then after their child dies, they'll come back to a community like Peoria, and they might be at a grocery store, and somebody who was their friend will see them coming down the aisle, and they'll know that they've made eye contact, and that person will just avoid them completely. They'll just walk right away. That is the most disturbing thing that can happen to a family. It's much worse to do that than even to say the wrong thing. And so the most important thing that we can do is to lean into suffering. And when we sense suffering around us, to pause, you know, put our phones down, make eye contact, just say, oh man, I mean, that sounds really difficult. Tell me more about it. Be willing to lean into that suffering. And then, like I said, try to be the most compassionate person you possibly can be.
Justin Baker is with St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, and he spoke with Tim Shelley. St. Jude has also introduced a program to allow St. Jude parents who have lost children to volunteer as guides for others suffering more recent loss. You can hear more of our interview with Baker at statewideshow.com. As grassland and prairies gave way to farmland in the Midwest, habitats for some native birds disappeared. There's a relatively new program in central Illinois that's looking to restore wetlands for migrating birds and helping farmers at the same time. The program to help them is limited, and the future for both the birds and the program could be on shakier ground in just a few years. Today we revisit a story from Madeline Beck with Harvest Public Media.
That's the sound of researchers trying to gently, or not so gently, put together a tower with antennas to help track birds. More specifically, track American golden plovers. It's a bird about the size of a Coke bottle on spindly legs, and it has one of the longest migrations of any bird, constantly on the move from Argentina up to the Arctic Circle. Ben Williams is leading plover research with the Illinois Natural History Survey and Prairie Research Institute, and he says the bird's stopover in central Illinois is important because they're fueling up to finish their trip north to breed. They need to eat a solid amount, or
they might not breed very well, or they'll have a failed nest, and then you start to see population numbers dip.
There's only a few hundred thousand of them total. It's a bird of conservation concern, meaning there's worries about its long-term survival, but there's not enough data to list it as threatened or endangered. Here's a research recording of what they sound like. William says a key habitat for the bird is shallow puddles and fields, which could help it get food like worms. And that happens to be habitat for other kinds of birds too, like ducks, geese, killdeer, sandpipers.
Greater and lesser yellowlegs, willets, and avocets. And there's a whole suite of bird species called shorebirds that like to wade in very shallow water or mud, kind of mud flat areas.
But those areas disappear when farmers use field tiles, that is, underground systems that help siphon water off of fields. Drier ground makes it easier to plant, grow crops, and work with heavy machinery. But shorebirds lose out. So there's the SCARCE program. That's Shorebird Conservation Acreage via Drainage Runoff Control Program. Oofta. It pays farmers to let water pool in their fields. It also helps pay to put in structures that keep that water from draining off. Farmers just need to stop up water from February to mid-April, which is usually before they plant and when plovers migrate through. Farmer Bruce Thompson, out near Allerton, Illinois, is a fan.
Glad that I could participate, and everything has been great.
Thompson gets paid for the few acres of water that pool on his property. For new participants, it's about $1,000 an acre, up to $5,000. Returning participants get half that. Another benefit is that stopped-up water gives farmers' soil more time to soak up nitrogen, leaving less for waterways and more for his crops. Thompson can even use those water control structures to keep moisture in his fields if it gets dry in late summer. He also just likes birds.
Of course, we're all for birds. My wife is a bird watcher.
But who is paying for all of this? There's a bit from the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, the University of Illinois, the National Audubon Society, and the National Resources Conservation Service. That last one, the NRCS, is a federal service that helps promote field practices like using cover crops or these water control structures. Those help keep nutrients like nitrogen in the soil so it doesn't get into streams and rivers, boosting harmful algal blooms and leading to a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. But like the fields themselves, the program funds could dry up in just a few years. And Kirk Stadola, an associate ornithologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, thinks this kind of conservation could stave off potential troubles down the line.
I think that there's so many uncertainties that you start to remove species or not care about what's out there, and that can lead to many unforeseen consequences that we don't know about right now.
Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
This winter, fewer bald eagles are spending time along the Mississippi River near the Quad Cities. Michelle O'Neill reports the reason may be mild weather, plus some other factors.
During this year's midwinter bald eagle count, wildlife biologist and consultant Kelly McKay counted 912 between Clinton, Iowa and Keithsburg, Illinois. It's the fourth lowest count in the last 20 years for that 80-mile section of the river. The Hampton ornithologist is also very concerned that the number of immature or young bald eagles was lower this year. Over the last 20 years, McKay says the percentage of immature eagles he's counted averaged 38%. This year, it was only 25%.
There are more and more eagles that are now wintering inland, and people take that as a good sign. They think it's a good sign because we're seeing eagles in places we never saw them before. That must mean there's so many more eagles. To me, that's not necessarily a good sign. Bald eagles are a fish eagle. They should be tied to the river systems. That's where they're supposed to be. And if they're going inland away from the riverways, there's a reason for that, and I think they're being forced inland to find food resources.
Bald eagles mainly eat a fish called gizzard shad. Eagles didn't roost in large numbers along the Mississippi this year because of a lack of ice on the river, and that may have also contributed to the lack of gizzard shad. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
You're listening to Statewide, and just ahead, people moving out of Illinois. What are some ways local communities can stem the tide? Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll look back at one town 15 years after a major employer closed down. And later, we'll meet the founder of Crosses for Losses. It's all ahead on Statewide. Illinois' population dropped for the sixth year in a row, and students leave the state for school at higher rates than almost anywhere else. For our Illinois Issues report this week, Peter Medlin looks at how the city of Rockford is trying to leverage its engineering and manufacturing industry to get people to stay.
Half of the state's manufacturing workers are retiring in the next 10 years or so. The Illinois Manufacturers Association says that's going to leave a glaring need for production workers and engineers. Manufacturing has long been a key cog in Rockford's economic engine, and its leaders know they have to invest in it if they want the area to flourish into the future. A few years ago, Rena Cacciones helped jumpstart the Northern Illinois University engineering program at Rock Valley College in Rockford. She's the Associate Vice President for Outreach, Engagement, and Regional Development at NIU. The idea was if they could cut down the barrier of having to drive to their main DeKalb campus, they could make engineering more accessible to Rockford students.
Collaboration is the new imperative. Nobody has enough resources to do these kinds of things on their own. We have to come together and link and leverage our resources to be able to solve our local problems.
So they partner with RVC along with businesses like Woodward, an aerospace manufacturing company. The first class of students from the collaborative program just graduated. Ghazi Malkawi is one of the engineering professors. He says the first class was small, only about 20 students, but he says it's grown significantly since then.
So out of the 19 students, 18 students basically found full-time opportunities in local companies. Most of them basically stayed in companies where they did their internships.
A lot of those internships were with companies like Woodward or Collins Aerospace.
I can tell you, even from schools in large cities, probably students won't have the opportunities that students have here.
Michael Wookie is walking out of his dynamics class at RBC. He's in his second year of the mechanical engineering program, and he's already taking some NIU classes where he'll be next year. He transferred to RBC from a four-year school, and he says he's saving a lot of money, and the program fits him better.
It is aimed a little more towards the hands-on practical aspect, which I really like.
Rock Valley is also partnering with Rockford Public Schools to let some high school seniors take engineering classes and build that pipeline from Rockford students to Rockford jobs. That RVC senior semester is open to students in their high school's engineering pathway. RPS recently revamped their college and career academy model. Now each academy has a local business sponsor. Collins Aerospace is that partner for their production academy. Bridget French is executive director of the College and Career Readiness for RPS.
How do we get kids excited and aware of things that are going on in our region? But how do we get them just thinking about STEM? You know, making sure that girls especially are aware of these because we want to be intentional about diversifying our workforce.
Cultivating awareness has to start early. Collins recently collaborated with the local Discovery Center Museum to create a mobile STEM lab to bring experiments to local elementary schools. Back at NIU, Rena Caccione says it's crucial for the schools to engage with local companies.
We also need those local companies to stay in town. They are no longer, many of them, headquartered in the Rockford area. So there is always this threat that a company could decide not to continue their presence in Rockford.
And to show they're in it for the long haul, she says they need to check in on each other.
I mean, we have the top person at Woodward in Rockford meeting with us every Monday at 7:30. That is, to me, just incredible.
Those meetings offer them an ear into the industry many schools don't have, and it allows them to think proactively. Seeing a trend towards robotics, RVC is now offering a new mechatronics engineering degree, and they hope eventually to bring it under the RVC-NIU umbrella. With students leaving Illinois, people like Caccione say collaboration is key no matter the industry, and it's going to be up to local communities to solve the workforce problems of tomorrow. They also consider how when they're selling potential students on the Rockford engineering industry, they're also selling them on Rockford as just a good place to work and live. Michael Wookie is thinking about that right now, and he says he doesn't feel the pull to move towards the coast to be an engineer. He likes Rockford, the suburbs and the state parks in the area, and he wants to stick around. I'm Peter Medlin.
In Illinois, birth rates are down and more people are leaving the state, and those demographic trends are putting pressure on Illinois policymakers to revitalize local economies. Jenna Dooley tells us more.
Since 2010, Illinois lost more than 159,000 residents. That's more than the entire population of Rockford. And a new study from Northern Illinois University's Center for Governmental Studies found these losses are seen across the state. Researcher Norm Walzer says the trends leading to population loss are expected to continue.
I've had a long history in studying rural, and I think we're concerned about what are the implications for the non-metropolitan areas, what kind of strategies, if any, can be taken.
The largest projected population declines over the next 5 years are in western and southern Illinois. Researcher Brian Harger says creating robust job pipelines is a strategy to keep skilled workers from leaving the state.
Sterling Rock Falls area, some of the manufacturers there tried a program of identifying high school students that were headed to college that wanted to major in engineering and creating a program to support them either through tuition reimbursement or helping them pay down student loan debt after they completed their degree.
But Harger says efforts like these take planning.
There is front-end investment with that, but again, you have to be creative because these are areas that are losing young people. And so you're already taking people who have grown up in the area, have some connections and familiarity there, that's really your best market to target first rather than trying to go and find people who don't live there.
Walzer says the negative implications of out-migration come down to simple mathematics.
What that means is there are fewer people to pay the taxes. So unless you're able to restructure the delivery system of services, then if you keep the same number of governments and you keep the same number of employees and you just advance that by inflation or whatever, but there are fewer people to pay the bill, then the per capita or per household property taxes are going to be substantially higher.
Harger says when there are fewer taxpayers, local governments suffer.
And you also have to factor in the pension burden for local governments, which is substantial. And all those obligations have to be paid.
Walzer says there may also need to be conversations that could prove controversial.
Do we have to have 102 counties? As just one example, I'm not picking a county. I think now six or seven of them are below 5,000 population in a whole county. So do the two counties have to consolidate?
If that were to happen, wouldn't consolidation mean job cuts? Walzer says yes.
But the alternative is our property taxes are going to go substantially higher.
Walzer says solutions will require residents and local leaders to work together.
At the state level, we can now make cannabis legal or something like that. But it has to be somebody at the local level that attracts, in the case of hemp, that attracts a plant to process the hemp that one of the local growers decided to grow.
It's not all doom and gloom. Harger says Illinois has assets that could attract new jobs and residents.
You know, Chicago, we have a nice concentration of research and development organizations, both public and private, you know, concentrating on trying to take some of those resources, marshal them, commercialize new technologies, and commercialize them here so that the jobs created are here.
Harger says he hopes the research motivates communities.
Number one, understand the nature of the problem they have. And then number two, decide we're going to do something proactive to deal with it.
And even if the population is expected to keep going down, Walzer warns the state's next big test is getting an accurate census count to ensure federal funds aren't lost for the people who do still live in Illinois. I'm Jenna Dooley.
You're listening to Statewide. Think of a movie that has at least one character who's a reporter. There are plenty to choose from. Maybe it's a fictional work, like It Happened One Night, or a movie based on true events, such as The Post. A new book details hundreds of films involving journalists. And Rich Egger has this report.
The book's title is, appropriately enough, Encyclopedia of Journalists on Film. The author is Richard Ness. He's a professor of film studies at Western Illinois University. Ness says the book includes entries for about 500 films, though he analyzed more than 4,500. He thinks so many films involve journalists because the press is pervasive in society.
One of the things I was trying to do was define a genre of journalism films. And it's a challenge because it crosses over into every other genre. I mean, you have in Westerns, you have the guy running the newspaper in town. Horror films, you have, you know, journalists investigating the supernatural events. You even have journalists singing in musicals occasionally. So it crosses all these other genres. But when I looked at what defined journalism films as a genre, the kind of key element was the idea that there's a quest for truth. I think it represents this value of our society that we want the truth eventually to come out. We're living through it right now.
Journalists appearing in film or actors portraying journalists, is this something that dates back to the beginning of film?
Oh, yeah, right from the start. I have a colleague at University of Southern California, a guy named Joe Saltzman, and he's been putting together a database. And he's got he does not just films, but all forms of popular culture. He runs a site called The Image of the Journalist in Popular Culture through the Norman Lear Center. So it's ijpc.org if anybody wants to check it out. And his database has about 90,000 items. He has, you know, graphic novels and plays and television shows and things like that. And Joe has been working on the silent era and starting even before we kind of think of when movies first had public showings, because he's finding even these old kinescope movies that they ran in parlors, you know, where you'd sit in a viewer and turn the crank and watch the film go through the viewer. And he's even found a few of those with journalists in them. So he's gone back and found stuff that I didn't even know existed. Between the two of us, we're kind of obsessive about this.
Do you have a particular favorite film?
Oh, you know, after 4,500 of them, it's really hard to single out. I will say my students absolutely, when I taught it as a course subject a few years ago, my students absolutely loved All the President's Men, which I thought might date a little bit, and they might not know all the Watergate history and things. But they found it, you know, just a really perfect kind of demonstration of what a journalist does in the day-to-day work and how you build a story and things like that. I have some films that nobody's heard of that I like. There's a film called The Day the Earth Caught Fire, which is a science fiction film. Basic premise of it is the Earth gets tilted on its axis wrong and it's heading closer to the sun, and planet is heating up. This was made in 1961. This is, you know, global warming in extremis. And it's all shown through the eyes of a London newspaper staff that's trying to get the story. So it has that kind of traditional journalistic feel to it, even though it's a science fiction movie. So there's also a film called The Great Man that I showed as part of my summer film series a few years ago, where the radio reporters are trying to find out about a broadcaster who died, and they find out he wasn't quite the positive public image that he portrayed. And I think that's a really good kind of forgotten film.
Richard Ness is a professor of film studies at Western Illinois University. His latest book is Encyclopedia of Journalists on Film. It's available in hard copy and on Kindle, though Ness acknowledges it's not cheap. He recommends asking your local library to purchase a copy. Rich Egger reporting.
For a blind sports fan attending a game in person, it helps to listen to the game on headphones, but the broadcast is usually delayed several seconds from the live action, and it doesn't begin to describe everything going on in the ballpark or the arena. Mind's Eye is an organization based in Belleville that tries to fill in the blank spots for sports fans with visual impairments. For St. Louis Public Radio, Jeremy Goodwin brings us this story.
It's about a half hour before puck drop at the Enterprise Center, where the St. Louis Blues are taking on the Edmonton Oilers. Fans are still filling up the arena. Up in a luxury suite, 17-year-old Gabriel Gregson is getting his hands on some game-used hockey gear spread out on a table. Mind's Eye President Jason Frazier explains to him what each object is.
A couple of the game-used gloves, too.
Who wore those damn things? Like, that's huge.
And then also, like, right in front of you, you want to put your hands on the table there. That's a Tarasenko jersey.
This?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, right now you have your hands on the 9 and the 1.
Gregson needs the audio tour of this memorabilia because he is blind. He's one of 6 young people at the game tonight who are blind or visually impaired and listening in on headphones to a live description provided by a Mind's Eye volunteer. It makes him feel like a part of things.
I mean, I'm able to go like, ooh, ah, with all the fans along with everyone else.
Mind's Eye made its name producing radio broadcasts for the blind, with volunteers reading out loud from newspapers and magazines. 3 years ago, it started providing live descriptions of theater performances and museum tours. This fall, it signed on to do the same for an eclectic list of events at the Stiefel Theater and Enterprise Center, like WWE Professional Wrestling, Baby Shark Live, and NHL Hockey. Mind's Eye volunteer Corey Sturtevant is describing the game tonight. He's standing at a counter in the suite, talking into a mouthpiece. A group of visually impaired hockey fans is nearby, listening in on headphones.
Has it to the right of the goalie. Passes it up to Petrangelo at the point. He passes it to Perron to the right of the goalie.
During gameplay, Sturtevant sounds similar to what you'd hear on the radio broadcast of the game. But he also tries to convey the whole experience of being at the arena, like when team mascot Louie pulls a prank out in the seats.
Oh, there's Louie in a Santa outfit. He's got a bucket of something. Oh, he just dumped ice all over an Edmonton Oilers fan. That Edmonton Oilers fan is mighty wet right now. All right, we're back to action. The defenseman for the Edmonton Oilers.
Or when the ice crew skates out during a break in the action to clean up the rink.
Jackets, people just, all of them got sock hats on with shovels. They're just skating left to right, right to left, just going around, cleaning up the creases of the goalies.
For a blind hockey fan trying to enjoy the live Enterprise Center experience, those details make a big difference. Andrew Adolfson is 22.
So it really makes me feel like I'm a part of the game, and I'm not excluded from the game. It feels really, really nice.
Feeling a part of the game versus feeling excluded. That's the gap the folks at Mind's Eye are trying to bridge, even if only one hockey game at a time. It's a gap Gabriel Gregson knows well. He was the one getting his hand on the hockey gloves and jersey before. Tonight, he can say this.
I'm feeling pretty included here.
But does he feel that way at many games?
No, that is not. That is almost never the case, even in school.
He's in the marching band and the pep band at Triad High School, where he's a junior. But once the football or basketball game starts, he's left out. He can't find someone who's willing to describe it for him.
Yeah, they don't really care about it. Like, they don't want to do it. It hurts. It really hurts. Because I want to have the same fun as everyone else, but it really hurts.
Passes it back to the defenseman. And he It's stolen. Brayden Schenn has a breakaway.
The Blues score first this night and beat the Oilers 2-0. But the big win tonight for this group is not just the result of the game. It's in feeling a part of things. Getting to cheer for the goals, yeah, but also to laugh when that bucket of ice lands on an Oilers fan. I'm Jeremy Goodwin, St. Louis Public Radio.
There's more of Statewide ahead. Follow our website at statewideshow.com and get our podcast through the NPR One app. This is Statewide. After more than 20 years of helping communities and individuals heal after a tragedy, an Aurora man decided to step away from the project. Greg Zanis created Crosses for Losses, and over the years, he's memorialized victims of natural disasters, mass shootings, and random violence with a simple cross. Brian O'Keefe of WDCB reports.
For most of his life, Greg Zanis was a resource for homeowners hoping to spruce up a kitchen, basement, or bath. His carpentry skills would come to dominate his life, even after he retired from remodeling. Zanis made and took 58 crosses to Las Vegas after the 2017 mass shooting. He took 49 more to Orlando after the Pulse nightclub shooting, and 6 more just down the road from his home after last February's factory shooting in Aurora. He also took crosses to Paradise, California after wildfires swept through, and to communities that found themselves in the crosshairs of tornadoes, hurricanes, and floods. Zanis has created thousands of memorials, but Crosses for Losses started on a much smaller scale. In 1996, Zanis found his father-in-law, Ralph Stadler, shot to death at the bottom of a stairwell in Aurora.
It was not something I expected. You know, he was my best friend for 25 years. He had taught me how to become a carpenter. But then I joined a support group at my wife's church, a Catholic church down the street here, and a lady came in and had just lost her son that day, a 6-year-old Nico Contreras. She came to the support group. She knew it was down there. She said, would I build a cross for her son? And she would pay me $20. And I said, well, no, I wouldn't charge, but I was back within an hour and a half or so, you know, and put my first cross in that day. And immediately people started responding to this. And, you know, I had it in around noon. And at about 8 o'clock at night, there was a crowd of 300 or 400 or 500 people just silently there. And the father was screaming, you know, why? But the peace that cross brought, I immediately realized right that minute that this is what I'm going to do for the rest of the people in the support group. So not to be complicated, the 15th cross, which was within a week, was from my father-in-law. It just gave me comfort, myself. And immediately, within a few years, I'd put up 250 or so crosses.
He continued to make the memorials for victims on and off during 1997 and 1998. But the aftermath of April 20th, 1999, would elevate the profile of Zanis's Crosses for Losses.
I was invited to Columbine, and I was asked to bring 15 crosses down, and it offended a lot of people that I put crosses up for the two gunmen, a whole lot. So it was complicated. I went down there, removed the scene. I just felt I was hurting people. Then I got back to Illinois. People were begging me to put them back up again, and I ended up going back and forth to Denver 5 times in 30 days. Very complicated, you know. I put them up, the government took them down, a private individual gave me an acre. I went and put another set up, came back, and then Chapel Hill Memorial gave me 35 lots in a cemetery to put up the crosses again, which eventually becomes a granite permanent memorial. Very, very complicated, but very easy. And from that day on, I went and toured these Columbine crosses to 500 cities with every parent of Columbine. I was inviting them to be the keynote speakers. I never spoke at any events. And then I kind of laid it down. I said, you know, this is too much. So I quit the touring, I guess that's what you call it. And then Red Lake, Minnesota happened in 2003. This is several years later. So I went up to the Indian Reservation and put them up there. But in the meantime, I'd constantly increased the number from a few hundred to several thousand immediately. I was in every state, and I always carried extra crosses.
Zanis also made crosses for each of the victims of the mass shootings at Virginia Tech University, Northern Illinois University, and Sandy Hook Elementary School. Typically, he arrives, places the memorials, and leaves as quickly as possible.
I saw this as a mission, a calling. I really don't accept awards or certificates or honors. I've been asked to do all of those. I've been asked by unbelievable people to come and, you know, all the presidents have tried to get a piece of me. You know, I don't give that any credit, you know. I mean, I avoided Trump twice at the temple, you know, was asked to stay in Alabama where there was a tornado, I was asked to stay to meet him. And I tell him, I'll be there, but I'm really already home by then. I'm not looking for any self-gratification. I'm doing this for, you know who I'm doing it for the victims, that they have a way that they can be, their family member can be remembered. If I stayed for 3 days, it'll all be about Greg Zanis.
But he has made a few exceptions. Zanis made a rare and deliberate public comment after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando.
When I went to Orlando and put up the crosses, people in my town, they were very upset that I was going to go do this. Very upset. It's like the church community. All the more reason. I'm thinking, this is all the more reason. I was told not to come back. I just felt, and making 49 crosses was a lot of work, too. And, you know, by then I started adding the hearts to them. But when I went down there, I decided, and I rarely interview, that I'm going to do this. I'm going to say, love your neighbor, love your brother, and don't judge him. So on the way in town, I was listening to a radio station in Orlando and two pastors and a rabbi, and they were just bashing gay people. But on the way out of town, those same three people realized, they said, Greg Zanis made it clear. You know, we're hating. Immediately, I brought a calming down to a city that was really anti-gay. And I realized, wow, the power here, you know. And I scheduled a prayer vigil, but I didn't go to it. I do that a lot, you know. But since then, I was putting up, you know, thousands of crosses a year immediately. And it was just like nonstop.
The Aurora man has no doubt his crosses for losses have made a difference.
I've seen America's heart change. Because I've been to all of the different ones, like I went to the temple in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where 11 Jewish people were murdered. I went to the Shiite temple in Milwaukee, were a different faith. I went to, you know, the gay nightclub in Puerto Ricans. I went to Las Vegas, where it was a country music festival. And immediately when I put crosses in a grouping, whether it's Nashville at the Waffle House, it changes everybody. First thing they do is quit talking about the gunman. That was a major goal. Talk about the victims here. When I went to Vegas, they quit talking about the gunman the second I put some names and pictures on those. And what I'm seeing is, it's not just Vegas. When that happens, you know, people from Orlando, they want to come in. People from Newtown. People from the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting. And all of a sudden, I'm making the war zones in America a family. You know, we're not letting this define us. We come out victorious every single time when we put those crosses up. And tens of thousands of people came out to Las Vegas. I cannot even begin to tell you, 24 hours a day, the crowds and the healing that offered. And just our nation wasn't looking at the bad anymore. They're seeing how we come together.
On January 1st, Zanis officially turned the operation over to the Northbrook-based Lutheran Church Charities. It already responds to many of the same incidents with its Comfort Dog program. He says last year proved to be just too much.
I went to 41 homicide, you know, major shootings, 41. And starting the year off, it was really hard for me sitting right here. And, you know, I'm watching all these police cars go by, you know, 20, 25, 30, 35. And finally my daughter comes, you know, into the shop and says, "Dad, there's an act, I don't want to get emotional. Dad, there's an active shooter here in Aurora." I just didn't see that coming. You know, I'm just this dumb, blindsided by this whole thing. All of a sudden, it's something I really wasn't wanting to do anymore. What really was the straw that broke the camel's back is when I went to El Paso. And I drive there, you know, not a two-day drive, but, you know, I made the crosses, and I hadn't slept in a couple of days. And on the way down there, you know, I'm much more famous than I realized. I had 14 family members call me before I got there. So I had confirmed names before the coroner releases the names. And then I'm there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden, all these family members start coming out, and they're lined up waiting for me to write their sons or daughters or relatives' name. And a lot of them didn't speak any English. And it just started to wear on me.
Zanis collapsed in El Paso, but he didn't stop. Exhausted and still feeling the effects of the heat, word came of another mass shooting, this one in Dayton. So he left South Texas and headed to Ohio.
The president had just been there and riled up the city. Believe me, there were National Guard at each end of the street. And it was getting close to dark, you know, and they said they didn't want me to go. Well, I picked up Elliot McLaughlin. He was a reporter for CNN in Illinois before I crossed over to Ohio, and he rode in with me. And it was just such a calming when my truck went down that street with those crosses on it. But when I left there, and I only stayed about an hour or 2 hours, it was an overwhelming calm that I left, you know, those crosses there. And I've seen similar before, but never like that before. It's starting to wear, you know, and I'm doing the Vegas anniversaries. And, you know, Thousand Oaks was in California, another shooting at a bar. And, you know, not to be backwards, but just before Thousand Oaks, I did the temple in Philadelphia, just a week or 11 days earlier. I didn't even have my truck unpacked. You know, I keep blankets and pillows and, you know, all the stuff. So in California, I decided, you know, I'd already decided that this is what I'm going to do. So then I started setting up states. I set up Texas. I set up Florida. And pretty soon I got a list of 26 states that want to do this with me, with the Lutheran Charities, and now that's expanded to 135. You know, that's not my list. That's mm-hmm. their list.
For 24 years, Greg Zanis has repeatedly gone to the scenes of mass shootings and from one natural disaster to another. It's clear Crosses for Losses has taken a toll on the man behind the project.
Every single time I leave a city, without exception, you know, I break down. I don't know how I made it through that, you know, pretending I'm somebody that I'm not that person. It's taken a huge personal toll on me, more than anybody can understand. I need to quit this for my own, you know, and I think it's a very mature decision to have it carry on by somebody else. So I can't even tell you how hard it's been. Can't tell anybody how one man out there looking like, you know, he can handle it, and I can't do this anymore. Last year was just too hard.
Zanis plans to spend his time now in the garage. In 1974, long before Crosses for Losses, before he and his wife were even married. He bought a 1927 Cadillac limousine.
And I've never stopped and worked on it. You know, my intention wasn't at 65 to be running around the country. I was going to spend a few years. I wasn't going to make a points car, but I was going to make a driver out of it. And now I can see where I can actually do that.
Brian O'Keefe spoke with Crosses for Losses creator Greg Zanis. In January, Zanis turned over control of the project to the Northbrook-based Lutheran Church Charities. That's it for this week Statewide. Be with us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes, including this one, can be found at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.